All right, yeah, I want to thank Albio for giving me the opportunity to talk about some of our recent work on the electron dope superconductors. So this work is actually supported by NSF and DOE. So most of what I'm going to talk about is actually the stuff that's not yet been published. And this is a part of a PhD thesis of my new graduate student, Stephen Wilson. And the sample were grown in my group by this postdoc, Shiliang Li, and Hengjie Wu, who I talked about yesterday, did some of the time of flight measurement with us. And we've been collaborating this with Wei Bao and NIST. We've been very fortunate to be collaborating with Jay Ho and Hai Zhang, now the former graduate, and she's now working at NIST, and then with Jeff. And at ISIS, at HMI, our local contact to the field effect, if I have a chance to talk about it, it's Dimitri, and then the ISIS is Chris Frost. And before Sun Heng left NCNR, he was our local contact. And of course, we've been talking to Herb frequently. Initially, our sample were grown by Yuichi's group, and now we grow our own samples. And finally, we have talked about a lot with Chi Miao about the theory aspect of the work. So we all know the phase diagram of high-TC superconductors. In the case of a whole dope material, it's very well known that when you dope it, the new temperature goes down very quickly. And then you have this spin glass regime, and then the superconductivity occurs after, in the case of a lanthanum strontium copper oxide, after about 5% doping. So what's actually happening is actually quite strange, because naively you would have thought in the case of a long-range ordered anti-ferromagnet, if you simply putting holes into it, you essentially simply disorder the long-range ordered states. You effectively would expect to see broad short-range spin fluctuations that should still be centered around the anti-ferromagnetic breakpoint. And that's, in fact, it's not what's happening. What's happening is that when you suppress this long-range ordered anti-ferromagnetic state, and you form a spin density wave state, and in the case of a lower doping, it's a two peaks, and then in the case of a higher doping, it becomes a four peaks, which I will discuss more. And then our ultimate goal then is to try to understand what happens in electron dope materials. That is to say, how do we drive a long-range ordered anti-ferromagnet to a superconductor? Try to see whether there's an electron hole symmetry. So let me talk a little bit about the materials aspect of the systems. Now, one of the systems that have been very well studied is the lanthanum strontium copper oxide, which has this famous a copper oxygen octahedra in which you have this apical oxygen both on top and bottom. And the key difference in the case of electron dope material is that the structure is a tetrahedral, which is called T prime structure, and actually do not have these apical oxygens. And of course, TCs are different. In the case of lanthanum strontium, you can get up to 40K, whereas the highest TC electron dope materials are around 25 degree Kelvin. And most recently, our effort has been focused on this new family of material, which is the praseodymium lanthanum cerium copper oxide. And this is because the praseodymium has a singular ground state in these materials. And also, the phases are much purer as compared to NCC, or traditional electron dope superconductor. So now let me talk a little bit about more detailed about how this transition occurs in the case of whole dope materials. As I said, the long-range ordered anti-ferromagnet quickly gets suppressed. But before you actually drive yourself into the superconducting state, the system actually becomes a so-called spin density wave or spin glass regime, in which you form these very long-range ordered Bragg-like peaks within the plane. But these peaks are very much short-range ordered along the c-axis, and that means they're almost two-dimensional in real space. And when the system drives into a superconducting state, then these two peaks suddenly becomes these four peaks. Of course, the microscopic origin of these four peaks is still under debate. Some people argue it's due to Fermi surface nesting. Other people think it's a signature of stripes. I'll not get into the detailed debate about how to resolve these two possible interpretations, but simply to say that it turns out these four peaks are intimately related to superconductivity, because no matter how you drive the system into a superconducting state, you can put excess holes into the system, as in the case of lanthanum 2 copper 04, by putting more oxygen, or you can replace lanthanum with strontium or with barium. It turns out it doesn't matter how you replace the system, as long as you have a finite TC of the system, and then the incompatibility, that is the distance of these four peaks away from Pi Pi is correlated with the transition temperature of the system. And this is the famous Yamada plot. And at least empirical point of view, this clearly suggests to us that there's some intimate relationship between this incompatibility and the superconductivity of these materials. And our question then, as I said earlier, is to understand what happens in the case of electron doped materials. And what we actually found was that when you drive the system from anti-ferromagnet into a full-blown superconductor, you also get into this regime in which you have a spin density wave coexisting with superconductivity. And in this case, except it is actually commensurate instead of incommensurate. I'll show you data to demonstrate how we determine this sort of a phase diagram, and it was just published like 2 months ago. Yeah. Oh, you mean as shown here?
Well, I mean, there was something which is just antiferromagnet plus spin density wave. So if they both have correlations.
Yeah. Okay. So the key difference is that in the standard long range order antiferromagnet, you would expect to see a spin correlation to diverge in all three directions in reciprocal space. I mean, in real space. That means they become instrument resolution limited in all three directions in reciprocal space. Whereas in the case of a spin density wave, as I said earlier, that in the case of Hall-doped materials, the hallmark is that they have rather long coherence length within the copper oxygen layer, yet they have a finite coherence along the C-axis. And what we have found in the case of electron-doped material, you also have similar features.
In other words, this you would say it's a 2D antiferromagnet, whereas the one at delta, roughly zero is a 3D.
Yeah. I mean, of course, the spin density wave is just a term that we borrowed from what people use in the case of Hall-doped material.
Are you saying you have superconductivity that improves about 11% electron
doping? Well, it's actually let me get back to this issue, because the electron doped materials, the exact carrier concentration in the material is not precisely known. Let me get back to this to this delta. So as I said, we've been actually finally after learning 2 years, we finally be able to grow this stuff ourselves, and it's actually been very, very helpful, because typically when as a neutron scatter, we ask people sample to ask for like 30 grams, and they look at you as if you're from another planet. So now with this capability, we essentially running 24/7, we can really grow as much as, well, still not quite enough as we wanted. This is the floating zone. This is the floating zone, infrared floating zone machine. While the sample is growing, and this is the actual sample that's coming out of it. Yeah. So one peculiar feature of electron doped materials is that when you grow this stuff as you've just taken out of a floating machine, it's actually not superconducting, and this is actually quite different from the case of a Hall doped material, in which as grown materials, in the case of lanthanum strontium, will be superconducting, has the right properties. And the case of electron-doped materials, all the grown samples are actually not superconducting. In order to make the stuff superconducting, you actually have to, do this what's called annealing process. And this annealing process, it turns out, has to be done in either vacuum or in very low oxygen concentration. Essentially, the only thing people know about this annealing process is that when you anneal the sample, that some of the oxygen comes out. As to exactly what happens and why this stuff becomes superconducting, there are various proposals, and there's no definitive answer as to what exactly happened. And in the following, I shall actually give you, our perspective as exactly, what we think is happening, when annealing occurs. So, yeah.
You ask whether you're fixed for the rest of the talk, is it like 12%?
Yeah, you now experiment. Everything's 12%. So this actually comes about to my next question. And therefore, in all the previous studies, that when people plot this sort of a phase diagram as shown by Fujita or Yamada's group, then earlier they just simply plotted as a versus as a function of serum concentration. And I say that this phase diagram is actually partially incomplete, in a sense there's completely one axis missing, because you don't really exactly know what is happening with your oxygen concentration, which is an axis that is actually perpendicular to this page. So therefore, the real phase diagram in the system is actually three-dimensional instead of two-dimensional. And therefore, our feeling is that instead of just simply plotting such a phase diagram with a very serum concentration, it's actually much better to do away with serum concentration, rather fixing one serum concentration and simply changing the oxygen concentration and see what happens with the system. In such a way, you know, you can avoid the complication of you know, different serum doping induces different disorder. And then, you know, in fact, you're only changing one parameter at a time instead of changing two parameters at a time. Because in all these you know, experiments in which, you know, people establish, you know, these phase diagrams, you know, people don't actually know, you know, what is their oxygen concentration. So in effect, you know, you're actually mapping some sort of a two-dimensional phase diagram in a three-dimensional phase, in a three-dimensional phase, you know, a space. So no, reduces, decreases. It has to be done in the vacuum.
So
or
if you inhale
oxygen, it changes. Yeah, in fact, this process is actually reversible. You can anneal the stuff in vacuum or in very low oxygen atmosphere and to make it superconducting. But then if you take the same sample and then put in air and cook it at 900 C, and the stuff will become non-superconducting. So it turns out when you suck oxygen in, the stuff will be non-superconducting, and then when you release oxygen, it will be superconducting. And now let me show you what is our proposal and exactly what happens. So previously, people, the naive interpretation or you know, the standard interpretation is that the reason the stuff becomes superconducting, the reason the stuff becomes non-superconducting is because as grown samples, you know, typically requires you know, fairly high oxygen pressure to grow the stuff. And what happens is that the people believe that you have what's called apical oxygen. And that means that in the standard structure, you know, there's no apical oxygen, right? In the standard T prime structure, what people believe was that, you know, when you scroll the stuff, you actually have these apical oxygen in there, and then the annealing process is actually releasing those apical oxygens, and therefore make the stuff more like a T prime structure, and therefore superconducting. And that scenario was around, you know, since early 90s when the electron doped material was first discovered. And recently, you know, this standard proposal has been, you know, challenged, has been incorrect, because people have found that the amount of apical oxygen in these systems, you know, before and after annealing, it doesn't really change. I mean, they're there both before and after. And then the question, you know, arises is, you know, what exactly happens in the system? Yeah. Yeah. By various methods. So exactly what happens, you know, It's extreme.
Fully.
Oh no, extreme. Yeah, Jeff is absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, this apical oxygen site we're talking about 0.1 to, you know, to certainly less than 1%. I mean, this actually, you know, places a dilemma, because you know, all the neutron measurement and you know, refinement stuff, you know, your only accuracy is to this percentage. It's very difficult to determine exactly, you know, how much oxygen you have in the system. You mean in the case of electron doped materials? No. In the case of electron doped, that's another difference between electron and hole doped materials. That in the case of hole doped material, you have this octahedra that's actually tilting back and forth, right? So it forms this zigzag, you know, wiggly. In the case of electron doped material, it's believed to be completely flat sheet. In a sense, structurally, it's much more perfect as compared to the case of hole doped materials. Okay. So one way, you know, we have learned over the years is that, you know, this was a very nice paper published in 1993, right after electron doped material was discovered. And the people have used a TGA measurement to actually determine how much oxygen is coming out. I mean, effectively, you know, at the temperature in which you anneal the system, the only thing that can come out is oxygen. And because that oxygen is the only thing that's actually, you know, mobile in these systems. So what happens is that, you know, depending on your oxygen, you know, partial pressure in the system, and for fixed, you know, temperature, then you can change the oxygen concentration by simply cooking the system, you know, at different temperatures. So if your partial oxygen pressure of the system is extremely low, as in the case of here, right, and then the amount of oxygen coming out of the system will depend, you know, very much on where you're annealing the system at. So based on this approach, you know, we have decided to do away the regular experiment, you know, as changing different serum concentration, but fix one serum concentration, essentially use the same sample, but cooking the system under different, you know, under, you know, very extremely low oxygen partial pressure and drive different oxygen coming out, and then see what happens to the phase diagram. And in fact, let me actually tell you, you know, something that we haven't yet published. We have a proposal in this paper, but we haven't published this yet. And Haijiang was supposed to be writing this paper up. We've done a very, very careful, you know, ICP measurement on all the samples that we have, and including both the powder sample as well as the single crystal samples grinded in powder, to determine exactly the chemical concentration in different materials. It turns out that in all the samples we have found, you know, there's always systematic copper deficiency in the material. And this is particularly severe in the case of single crystal, you know, grown materials, because in the single crystal grown materials, you know, in order to grow the stuff, you actually have to put excess copper initially. But even that, after you do all the analysis, you find, you know, your formula is not exactly, you know, what you think it is. So, you know, there's always a little bit of copper missing. So our proposal, and we've then done a very careful, you know, a river analysis on all these data, all these samples in which we've done the ICP measurement, and our belief, at least for the moment, is that what happens is that your Ascron samples, you know, this is the standard, you know, the structure for the electron doped materials. What we believe actually happens is that in Ascron samples, you actually have these copper deficiencies, and these are, you know, the copper sites. So what happens in the annealing process is that you're actually removing some of the deficiencies, some of these copper deficiencies by you know, get rid of one of the copper oxygen sheet. And therefore, you remove some of these coppers to other sites, and then filling all these other copper sites. And then, because you have this copper deficiency in the system, and what then has to happen is that you form this Bixby I impurity phase in between. And this essentially, you know, we believe, explains why this process is completely reversible. So it's really not a process of, you know, annealing, you know, produces a impurity phase. Rather, it's a process in which that you create copper, you create a more copper, perfect copper oxygen sheet, and then what's left, because the Ascron materials is actually copper deficient, and we've done ICP measurement on both Ascron and after, you know, annealing sample, and you never see any oxygen, and you never see any copper change. So the only thing that's actually happening is that your oxygen coming out, and in this process, your oxygen has to come out. So when you put oxygen back in, then you again form this defect phase, and this is our current belief, you know, of what's happening.
Do you think the same thing is happening in the holdups?
No. I think the reason probably because the reason probably because in the electron doped materials, the structure with a little bit copper deficiency is actually more stable. And these materials are notoriously difficult to grow, especially single crystals. I mean, that's why for a long time, you know, for 10 years, you know, no one was able to grow. NCCO is better, but the you know, pristine lanthanum cerium copper oxide is notoriously difficult. And there's only very, very small, you know, region of the zone in which the system is actually stable. So that's just my pure speculation. Right?
Would picture C imply a bigger resistivity or something?
Oh, well, I mean, Ascron stuff is actually semiconducting. It's actually insulating. And then when you drive it, you can gradually see. I mean, we actually, my postdoc, Shi Liang, he's actually doing a systematic study of it. Essentially, we're just using all this tech. I mean, I don't believe anybody else do the systematic study. So what we do is do one sample, and then he measure A, B, C resistivity, and then annealing it again, and then do it again systematically to see what happened to the system. So this is the outcome in the TC measurement. So you can see, you know, depending on how you anneal the sample, you know, again, we don't know exactly. We know how much, well, we're actually measuring how much oxygen is coming out, but we don't know exactly what the carrier concentration of the system is. But what we do know is that depending on, you know, which temperature you're anneal the system, you can gradually drive the system, you know, from insulator to a low TC and gradually to highest TC. And then if you further cook it, you can actually drive TC back down again. Of course, you know, if you cook at really high temperatures, the sample decomposes. So this is essentially, you know, again, you know, form some sort of a, you know, superconductivity dome, right? But except in this case, you know, we're only changing this one parameter, which is annealing temperature. And then the question is, you know, how do we understand this transition from a long range ordered anti-ferromagnet magnet to a full blown superconductor? And this is what we want to show you with neutron scattering. Yeah.
So if you come back to that original phase diagram,
you mean this one?
Just one slide back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you don't know the starting concentration of oxygen in this statement.
You don't know. So let me tell you what.
Delta, I mean,
yeah. What is it?
Four minus delta.
Yeah.
It's not you just
you're saying that it's not four.
Yeah. So let me tell you what this means. What this essentially means in our paper is that we have assumed that people the Kims et al. Have done a very careful the weight measurement to look at how much oxygen comes out. So what we have been assuming is that for the same sample that we have, that the same oxygen is coming out. But that axis, I agree, is in a sense somewhat arbitrary, and we're now doing a very careful measurement ourselves to see exactly. But
you can control delta, but you cannot control four. Is this correct?
Yes. That's a true statement because no one knows exactly, how much oxygen you have in the system. I mean, that's just not true for this electron domain, for the magnet, for anything, right? You just don't know, as grown samples. You know how much is coming out, but you don't know exactly, what its initial condition. But what we can do though is that we know in all of our samples the initial condition is the same, and that part we know. Yeah.
How do you know that the distribution of oxygen is uniform, but the sample is uniform and not sort of more depleted at the surface?
Yeah. So this is something we do with a TGA. So essentially, what we do is that we anneal the sample in a TGA, in which we precisely measure the weight to within, I can't remember what's the precision, the thermogravitational apparatus. So you essentially measure, it's just a balance, essentially. It's just a balance. that's true, right? it's just a balance that you can measure the weight to within 0.1 milligrams. And then you put a 1 gram sample, the weight change of 0.1 milligram. So we do this for, now actually he does it for more than a week. We cook it at the same temperature and we can exactly see the weight change. And then we can wait until this whole thing, completely equilibrates. And the weight does not change anymore on the order of days. And then we stop. I don't know what else to do, that's sort of the thing that we can do at this point.
Can you break apart and measure the densities of individual pieces?
Sorry? Oh. Well, actually, in all of these samples, that you can cut the top and bottom. That's we actually do that. For all of our neutron samples, we actually after we grow the sample, that which is typically on the order of 2 centimeters. So we measure the TC on top and we measure the TC on bottom, and they're essentially the same. Well, we have to use it for neutron experiment. We typically cut the top and bottom and check it. Well, what we measured, you mean to cut a piece in the middle?
It would be heartbreaking to cut it in half.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking to cut it in half. They're trying to grow as big as possible.
No, I think there have been measurements done to try to look at the cerium concentration, and you tend to get a little bit of a gradient in cerium from the outside to the inside. But that's not a big effect.
What about things like NMR? They would show you whether you have homogeneous or homogeneous sample, right?
Well, people actually have done very careful measurement on the sample. Yuichi have done on his sample. We haven't done on our sample. They found there's essentially very little serum concentration along the rod.
Not along the rod, through the rod.
Yeah, through the rod. We haven't done that. Yeah. So I'm not going to say I'm not going to declare there's none. But at least from TC measurement, we don't see much of a difference between here and here. I haven't really got into what I'm going to talk about yet, so my time is elapsing. Yeah. So now let me get into the scattering experiment. So one of the key difference between electron and hole doped material is that the electron doped material, its magnetic structure is actually slightly different from hole doped material. And this was actually thanks to Jeff. He first realized that the structure is actually non-collinear in the electron doped materials, and the parent compound Jeff studied was praseodymium-2-copper O4. So in this case, your spins in one layer, is actually rotated 90 degrees from spins in the adjacent layer. And if you look at this material in the case of a praseodymium lanthanum cerium copper oxide, even though the praseodymium has supposedly a singular ground state, supposed to be non-magnetic, but because the exchange coupling between praseodymium and copper, you actually can induce a very very tiny moment on the praseodymium. But those are only for the Osgroen samples. And if you make the stuff superconducting, then all evidence indicates that there's essentially no moment on the praseodymium site. to lessen the detection limit of neutron scattering on the superconducting samples. And that's not true in the case of a neodymium cerium copper oxide, which is a huge, humongous moment on the neodymium site. I believe mu SR has some problems because of the hyperfine field of the pristemium. So I mean there were some new Jeff Sonier. I mean they've done some mu SR experiment on not on pristemium lanthanum cerium copper oxide but on pristemium NCC or pristemium cerium copper oxide and he claimed that there was some problem with those measurements because of pristemium hyperfine field interaction. I'm not an expert on USR, so I won't be able to say anything about that. But in any case, I mean, so if given this peculiar magnetic structure, then typically your half type of zero peak is actually not allowed. And this is just simply the structure factor calculation shows that this peak is not allowed for this particular magnetic structure. And it turns out that the allowed peak are shown in these purple dot hydrogen. So in fact. So the first black peak, expected black peak, half zero, you actually do not allow to have a magnetic peak. So now let me give you evidence in what we believe what happens when you drive the system from long range order anti-ferromagnet magnet to a full blown superconductor. So this is a sample that's essentially a scroll non superconducting a scroll sample. So if you cool down, you do the magnetic black peaks on half zero. And you see this expected increase, right? And this is essentially shows you there's a long range order. There's long range standard anti-ferromagnet order in the system. And if you look at the position around the half zero type of position, you don't see any temperature dependence, right? So this is exactly what you would expect, right? So now let's look at a sample that with a TC of 16 Kelvin. So this is you cook a little bit, in the same sample, you cook a little bit, and then to drive a TC of 16 Kelvin, and then you can see that you still have this intensity change around half zero, as you would expect. But then, in addition to that, now you start to see intensity changes around half zero position. And if you look at another sample that with a TC of 21 K, it's still not quite optimum doping yet. And what you find is that this intensity increase on cooling from 52 K to 5 K actually reduced as compared to the a lower TC or higher TN samples, yet it's still there. But then you also see this smaller intensity changes around half zero. If you now look at a sample that's a full blown superconductor, which has 25 Kelvin superconductor, and then if you do temperature dependence on both the half zero and half zero, then you don't see any intensity change at all as a function of temperature. So that suggests that this sample has no static magnetic scattering. So this sample, by the time you get into a full-blown superconductor and your long-range order anti-ferromagnetism, at least your long-range order static anti-ferromagnetism is completely suppressed. So the situation in between, especially the case when we have this intensity around half zero, is very peculiar, right? So we wanted to understand, what is this intensity coming from? And it turns out...
A and E,
yeah.
Yeah, there is pi scattering.
So I'm sorry. Yeah, so this pi scattering you see in here are nuclear scattering, and these scattering it turns out it's coming from this Bixby impurity phase partially, and because it's nuclear scattering, it has no temperature dependence. So it's zero temperature dependence. You can do this thing at room temperature, 5K and 10K, it'll be identical. So the only way you can identify whether the thing has a magnetic signal or not is to look at the temperature dependence of the scattering. Because you would expect the magnetic scattering to decrease with increasing temperature. Whereas the nuclear scattering, stay put. So now the question is, what happened? Now the question is what happens for samples in between. So if you do very careful temperature dependence, now let me explain why we believe the upper samples has no has no magnetic scattering. You see, if you look at the figure that I showed you earlier, for example, if you look at this figure, if you look at this figure, you see your first expect, I mean, this particular position, your BCBI and your magnetic peak is mixed. But if you go to this particular Bragg peak, half one, you'd expect to see magnetic Bragg peaks, right? In a three-dimensional order system. And in the case of optimum-doped superconductor, you don't see any peak around half one, you know, or half three, at the positions where you expect to see magnetic Bragg peaks. So this essentially conclusively shows that whatever the stuff you're seeing at half zero is nothing to do with magnetism in the system. And then if you move on to do temperature dependence of half zero as compared to three half zero, you can see this, you know, gradual drop in intensity to 16K and then for the 21K sample. And then you can clearly see there's a gradual increase in intensity at the low temperatures. You know, it turns out, you know, I won't have time to show this in detail. It turns out this scattering is quasi two-dimensional. I mean, I just won't have time to show you the argument for that. But take my words for it. And this stuff is more or less, you know, three-dimensional. And so therefore, we believe this scattering, which occurs in a position that's dislodged from the standard box scattering, is actually due to the diffuse scattering, quasi two-dimensional-like scattering. And we call this stuff a spin density wave-like scattering. So therefore, from knowing the new temperature of the system, then you can establish the phase diagram, you know, as I've shown here. I mean, so in a sense, this particular phase diagram, so far, we've now done like 5-6 samples. We have two more points here now. And so far, you know, as far as this is concerned, you know, this phase diagram is only true, you know, for one serum concentration. So you can essentially drive the system, you know, from this, and then you have this mixed phase, and then you have fully blown superconductor. And then the very interesting question then would be that, you know, when you drive, if you can drive the system, you know, with a new temperature to zero, you know, what happened to the spin excitations? Whether this point, you know, can be considered as a quantum critical point. And this is what I wanted to, you know, mostly show you, you know, in the new data that has not been published yet. So you can see that, you know, instead of you know, a standard phase diagram of a two-dimensional, you know, with just you know, a serum concentration, now you really have to consider this phase diagram as you know, being three-dimensional, right? Have this additional, you know, oxygen concentration axis that you have to take into account. And if you take that into account, then if you plot, you know, the same view graph as I've shown you earlier, then, you know, you essentially have this three-dimensional case, and you have this superconductivity dome coming up, and then you have the suppression of a long-range order state. And then the very interesting question, you know, would be that would you have some sort of a quantum critical point here? And in order to verify that, then you have to, you know, do inelastic neutron scattering experiment. And for that, you know, we have picked two samples. We have a picked sample of a TC of 21K, and then we have picked another sample of a TC of 23K, very close. And this sample has a TN roughly of 10 Kelvin. I'll show you the inelastic spectra on these samples. And the quantum critical point, you know, the claim of a quantum critical point in the case of electron doped materials is actually not new, and it was you know, suggested some time ago by the transport measurement. Although, you know, transport measurement cannot really tell you what sort of quantum critical point you have, and so in this sense, you know, the work by Rick Green's group in Maryland have shown that you know, as you gradually, you know, they've done it on thin films, you know, in the case of you know, PCCO. I mean, I'm not sure, you know, how they control, I mean, the oxygen concentration, but assuming the oxygen concentration is all exactly four, then you know, what they have done is for different serum concentrations, you know, they can eliminate superconductivity by driving it into normal state. And what they have found is that if you plot this phase diagram, you know, versus serum doping, what they found is that around 15-16% on the left-hand side, you know, your resistivity actually, you know, increases when the superconductivity is eliminated, whereas on the right-hand side of the phase diagram actually goes to zero as metallic-like. So therefore, they identify at this point as being a quantum critical point and separating the insulating and the metallic regime. And their measurement also, you know, shows, you know, from the Hall coefficient measurement, and which actually changes sign right around, you know, 0.165, which they identify as a quantum critical point. And they actually do not know, you know, what sort of quantum critical point that is. And this is just shows, you know, their measurement showing, you know, the potential existence of a quantum critical point right around, you know, here. So from neutron scattering point of view, I mean, neutron scattering, you know, is really a microscopic probe, right? I mean, it's from neutron scattering point of view, if you do have, you know, some sort of a quantum critical point, if this quantum critical point is a standard quantum critical point. That is to say that you have a gradually seen a second order phase transition, you know, all the way suppressed to zero. And then what you would expect is that in the quantum critical regime, you would expect to see, you know, omega t scaling, and also, you know, you would expect to see the divergence of your coherence lens, you know, right around the standard second order phase transition, long range order anti-ferromagnetic and the quantum critical point. And this is exactly, you know, what we cut out to do. So for this purpose, you know, as I said, you know, we pick two samples, and we pick one sample here, and then we pick one sample here. And the difference between these two samples then, you know, for the sample further away from the quantum critical point, you'd expect to see your omega t scaling to be, you know, correct in this regime, whereas, you know, you can have a, you know, breakdown regime at lower temperatures because the renormalized, you know, classical regime. And then as you pick a sample closer to the quantum critical point, and then your omega t scaling regime should be the same, but it should be extended to a much, you know, bigger range, depending on how close you are to this quantum critical point. Now let me show you the data. This is the data for, I mean, as I said, you know, we picked two samples. And the first sample we picked is the sample which has a TC of 21K, which, as I showed you earlier, you know, has a TN of roughly equals to 40K. And if you do this elastic scattering, you know, this is a spin density wave, you can see this you know, intensity gradually increase. And if instead of looking at the elastic channel, if you now look at the inelastic channel, say, for example, a half a millivolt, and this is done on spins at NIST, you can see this magnetic intensity initially increase, and then turns over roughly around TN, and then gradually suppresses. And this is actually some sort of a hallmark in almost, you know, all the typical, you know, phase transitions, right? As you gradually get close to the transition, you essentially, you know, lose the inelastic channel because the elastic channel, you know, sucks up the intensity. And if you look at the inelastic spectra of the system at 2 Kelvin, and, you know, I mean, of course, you know, in all the scattering that is centered around pi, it's actually different from the the whole dope materials. And if you look at the spectra at 2K, you can see the magnetic scattering, you know, has no magnetic scattering in the energy loss side. And then gradually you see this broadish peak around the around 2 millivolt, 1.72 millivolt. And then when you increase the temperature to 40 Kelvin, intensity drastically increase. And then when you increase to 70K, intensity decreases again. And if you plot everything, if you look at the wave vector dependence of the scattering, and this is exactly what you see. You see at 2 Kelvin, which is a black circle, and you can see at the half millivolt, your intensity is low. Your magnetic intensity is low. It's centered around pi. It's not resolution limited. And this is your instrument resolution. It's quite broad. And if you look at the 1.5 millivolt, it becomes stronger. And then 4 millivolt, it drops down again. And this confirms the existence of this broadish peak seen at the low temperatures. And if you warm up the system, you can see the intensity drastic increase and decrease. Finally, when you warm up to more than 100K, they more or less disappear, at least, you know, around the around half a millivolt, more or less disappear, and it becomes much weaker. And if you look at the scattering along the C-axis, as I said earlier, you know, your magnetic scattering is essentially three-dimensional, whereas this excitation is, in fact, you know, essentially all quasi-two-dimensional. If you look at the modulation along the C-axis, you can see there's essentially no wave vector dependence. And this is a scan along the half-half L direction along the C-axis for half a millivolt and 4 millivolt. You can only see, you know, everything is magnetic because when you cool down, the intensity drops at 40K and 2K. And the solid line shows your background. So what essentially this data tells you is that your anti-ferromagnetic spin fluctuations form some sort of a checkerboard, you know, pattern within the copper oxygen plane. But these copper oxygen sheets are more or less uncorrelated from each other. Yeah.
Below the ordering temperature, you look at function of energy and wave vector. Do you identify spin waves?
Well, in principle, you should be able to observe, you know, spin waves in the system as well, right? But in practice, you know, this system, this is the only spin fluctuation we see. But the width of these excitations are actually much broader than the spin waves. We do not believe they're coming from spin waves. Let me show you in the next view graph. Actually,
are you saying you have spin waves and some additional sources of scattering which are broadening?
No.
The so-called spin waves?
No. What I'm saying is that the spin fluctuations we see, or the spin excitations we see, do not appear to be like spin waves. We cannot identify any spin wave-like features in the system.
Excuse me, what's the
supercondacting
gap here?
Well, we haven't, I mean, you mean the spin gap. We can, neutron, you know, doesn't measure direct superconducting gap, right? You can only measure the spin gap. And in this case, it's almost gapless. I mean, you have a very gentle-ish gap. Well, but we haven't done. I'm sorry.
Is there orbits which could identify the superconducting?
Uppers on this set of samples has been done by Hong Ding at the moment. I don't know the outcome. But the tunneling measurement hasn't been done on these sort of samples yet. There's no tunneling experiment on these samples. I'll show some tunneling if there's time. I'll show some tunneling data done by Rick Green's group, and they had a PRL this year.
The approximate size of superconducting
gap is great. From some other earlier studies.
Yeah, in the case of NCCO optimum doping, that's the only thing that's been done. I believe it's 2-3 millivolt. I can't remember exactly. Yeah. So this is the wave vector, and then if you look at the detailed temperature dependence of the excitations, you can see this broadish peak, and then you know they go up, and then they finally you know this is sort of the three-dimensional version of it that I show you around half. And now let me make this point of how do you compare this excitations with the standard spin waves, and the standard spin waves you don't have to go much, right? You just have to get a sample that before you cook it, so you would have a long range order three dimensional three dimensional long range order, and in those systems you can measure the spin excitations and which would be spin waves, right? And you can see here this is the measurement, this is the only measurement we've got, and you can see the system is actually gapped. Because you have this anisotropy gap, because the fact that the spins are actually non-collinear in the system. So you have this anisotropy spin, what we call XY gap, and so you don't see anything around half a millivolt, whereas in the superconductor, this is sort of the expected signal, if you overplot it. And then if you look at another sample, if you look at 1/2 millivolt, in the case of a spin wave, because J is so much larger, right, at such a low energies, everything is going to be around pi until you go out to 80, 100 millivolts. And you can see that the scattering we've seen is much broader than the spin waves on the same instrument. And of course, this is also true for the four millivolt. So we believe the excitations we've seen, are not coming from spin waves. And you can plot, the energy dependence, because it becomes broader as you increase energy. And you can on these same set of samples, you can actually go out to much larger energies to see exactly what happens. And this is the ISIS data we've taken, and we assemble like 8 crystals, about 25, 30 grams, and yeah.
Okay, so I missed it. But yeah. As the system got more superconducting, these got broader.
Yes. I'll come back to that. We have one more sample to show you. It's become even broader yet. So our argument, if I want to share the our argument is that your quantum critical point is not a standard second order phase transition quantum critical point. So if you look at the excitations, we can't do this on the reactor source because you can't close the triangle around half for such a large energies. But on time of flight, you can do. So far we've looked up to, 130, and now this week, they've looked up to 200 millivolt. They see excitation up to 200 millivolt. And what they have found essentially is that at really low energies, excitations are really centered around pi, they're very sharp. As you gradually march out, they become some broader and broader, finally sort of damps out at higher energies. But they seem to be always centered around in a blob around pi. And this is actually quite different from our measurement on the yttrium barium copper oxide, right? Where you see this incremental stuff, Herb showed, come and go, right? As you increase energy, you have this thing become that, and then turn around and blah blah blah. Whereas in the case of electron doped materials, as far as I know, this is the first measurement that's been known, at least up to 120 millivolts seem to be around pi, and just becomes much broader and weaker. So now we're ready to do some sort of scaling analysis. So if we look at all the data that from half a millivolt, all the way to 4 millivolt, and all the way to 100 millivolt, if you combine the ISIS data to the spins data, and if you plot everything in terms of omega versus t, and plotted chi double prime versus temperature, you can see this sort of curve. And a couple of things immediately caught your attention. One thing is that at really high temperatures, say for example, 120K, your stability is clearly deviating from this plot. Whereas at extremely low temperature and low energies, you know, for example, at 2K, you can see curve is deviating from the plot. At low temperature 10K, it's deviating from this curve. But if you do this quantum critical, you know, scaling analysis, you know, at extremely low temperatures and energies, you know, things has to be deviating away from your scaling analysis because you're on the left hand side of the quantum critical point. So therefore, if you consider yourself only the energies above, say, for example, you know, 3 millivolt, as in the case this sample, you know, the transition seems to be around 30 Kelvin, then if you consider all the data above 30 Kelvin, or all the data above 3 millivolts, 3 millivolts is roughly around 30 Kelvin, right? And then you, if you plot everything together, essentially from a 0.01, well, 0.1 to about 100, you can see more or less everything falls on this one curve. Yeah?
That, the way the data is sort of looking like it's falling is in this bunching kind of way. It's not, what I'm trying to say is, you know, it's not like the different color, there are non-overlapping regions of the different colors.
Oh, you mean in here?
No, in the lower one.
Here there are a lot of overlapping, right?
Is this overlapping?
Yeah, different colors.
Okay, we should talk later.
This is the same data as this.
Yeah, okay, but we should talk later. You know, the way the pink and the, so it's like different, it's not, in a way, that I wouldn't say it's really scaling, because that would have meant, you know, you have stretched regions over which the pink and yellow and all would.
Well, the blue goes, I mean, go all the way here, and then you have a red in the same region. I mean, these are different temperatures that's been done.
Okay.
And then, you know, the purple. Well, anyhow, I mean, this is sort of the data. This is sort of the data. And especially if you do, say, for example, at half a millivolt, if you do temperature dependence, and then, you know, you can essentially tune this thing, right? Because you're doing omega divided by T. So as you increase temperature, then this thing, as you increase temperature, actually, as you decrease temperature, this thing actually increasing. Like, right? You decrease temperature, this thing actually increasing. You can clearly see this thing, you know, deviates from the standard plot. I mean, this plot, you know, from roughly around 30 Kelvin, if you probe exactly at half a millivolt. And that's actually not, you know, I mean, that's just for one sample, right? And then the question is, you know, if you pick another sample that's even closer to the quantum critical point, would you be able to see the same scaling as you would in the other sample? But in this case, you know, in expanded, you know, omega T region, because you're now getting closer to the quantum critical point. And this was done like a month ago. Now we now look at a sample which has a 23 degree Kelvin TC. And this is a TC of this particular sample. And we look on the same instrument as we did on the other sample. And in this case, you know, I plot the scans around the half millivolt, and 1/2 millivolt, and 4 millivolt. And you immediately notice that as compared, you know, this dashed line is the sample for the 21K sample. You immediately notice that the spectra is actually broader. And the other thing you notice, and you know, even at 2K, this thing is not resolution limited. That means the coherence lens, even, you know, we've never gone to 0K, right? Even when you've gone to 0K, we don't believe the coherence lens will diverge at 0 Kelvin. But at 2 Kelvin, it actually becomes even broader. In a standard second order phase transition to a standard AF order, you'd expect, you know, the coherence lens to diverge, right? Just the new temperature systematically to lower and lower temperatures, right? And that's not what we're seeing. We're seeing actually for higher TC sample, and the width actually becomes broader. And in addition, and this peak at the 1/2 millivolt is no longer there. This is at 2K. And you see, remember in the 21K sample, you have a low intensity, high intensity, low intensity. Whereas in this case, the intensity systematically drops. So this is actually, if you plot everything together, then you know you can see your susceptibility at 2 Kelvin will sort of becomes. And so this broadish peak essentially disappears. So that means your characteristic energy scale is shifted inwards as you go closer to Tn equals to zero. And this is sort of the new temperature of the sample. And then, you know, this drastic up and down is more or less gone. But if you analyze this data the same way as you did before, and you know, so far we only, you know, was able to do, I mean, we only given like 4 days. Only was able to do like, you know, 2K, 30K, 60K, 100K. And if you plot everything together, and they seem to be falling on the same universal curve as the other sample, except if you do half a millivolt temperature dependence, you know, the thing starts to deviate from the scaling below 13K, which is exactly, you know, which is resolved roughly, not exactly, roughly where your new temperature is. Whereas in the other sample, it deviates from omega T scaling around 30, roughly 30K. So you seem to think that, at least from the data that we have, we seem to think that, you know, as you get closer to the omega, the quantum critical point, you know, omega T scaling, you know, stays more or less unchanged, except your region in which the thing deviates from the omega T scaling also decreased. So how does this, so I think I run out of time, right?
10 more minutes,
okay. Yeah. Okay. So how do we understand this business? I mean, certainly, you know, the data tell us. I mean, the omega T scaling obeys, you know, it may or may not tell you it's really a quantum critical point. But the point is that this quantum critical point, if it's there, it cannot be the standard, you know, second order phase transition, you know, your garden variety, you know, quantum critical point, you know, your new temperature simply suppressed to zero temperature, right? Because, you know, you would expect the coherence lens, you know, to behave differently as a function of a doping and as well as a function of a temperature. However, the data is actually rather similar to what Wei Bao had done, you know, in the case of a lithium-doped, you know, lithium-doped lanthanum 2-copper-04. I mean, this stuff is actually not superconducting, but also has a, you know, spin density wave-like feature around pi-pi. But except in his case, you know, his pi-pi scattering is actually resolution limited. And he's found this omega T scaling at high temperatures then deviates from low temperature, deviate from omega T scaling at low temperatures. And the other thing that's similar to the what Gay Apley has done, you know, many years ago. Actually, I guess this was in 97 on the superconducting a lanthanum 2-copper-04. And in this case, you know, I mean, they've looked at a sample that's close to optimum doping but not quite at optimum doping. And in this case, instead of having a one peak at pi pi, you have this you know, quartet of peaks around the pi pi. And then they've done a very, very careful temperature dependence, and by fitting the scattering function to this form. And this is sort of their data. What they have essentially found is that as you gradually increase the temperature of the system, you know, the peak width increases as a function of temperature, as well as it increases as a function of energy. And the peak width increases as a function of temperature, and the peak width increases as a function of energy is completely interchangeable. So they have found, you know, omega T scaling in this system in a sense that, you know, you can completely change the temperature, you know, versus energy, yet the width would stay the same. And in this case, even at the lowest possible temperature, which they actually haven't gone to because their sample will be superconducting, right, below some 30K, and will be intervened by superconductivity. But I don't believe, even in this materials, you know, people believe that your coherence lens actually diverges, you know, at low temperatures. So far as I know, you know, all the claims, at least from neutron scattering point of view, that of a quantum critical point in either electron or Hall doped materials, that you have omega T scaling, but your Q width never diverges. Yeah, by Stephen Hayden and Bernhard Keimer.
Is this something with the increased stability of the quantum
machines
that
the sample in the old days, you know, much less. I mean, before example, you know, the old day sample, they never see the splitting of the peaks in the case of lanthanum strontium, right? I mean, so the newer samples are. You know, I mean, that I believe Keimer's work and both Hayden and Keimer's work on lanthanum barium. So I'm not sure. You know, I mean, it hasn't been renewed work on it, but certainly, you know, I mean, one should look into it to see whether, you know. Yeah. Yeah. Well, even most recently, Bill Byers saw omega T scaling in his 6.35 sample. But he doesn't call it quantum critical point because his argument was that the coherence lens does not diverge.
Right, never mind how you call it, but
yeah.
It doesn't really have
to know. Yeah, yeah. In lanthanum strontium, in YBCU, that's also true, yeah. So I think rather the data is actually very similar to the work that we've done, as well as you know, Megan Aronson has done on the heavy fermions. In the case of heavy fermions, you know, for example, in the scantium uranium, you know, palladium, as well as uranium copper palladium, you know, you've seen, you know, this typical omega T scaling, but in those cases it's called local criticality because, you know, it doesn't really matter which wave vector you are. you always see omega T scaling. In fact, in this stuff, you know, you don't see any, this is expected antiferromagnetic, you know, wave vector. And you don't see any enhancement around here, yet it's, the system still follows omega T scaling. So what this seems to suggest is that this quantum critical point, you know, in the electron doped materials, if it is there, it cannot be the standard, you know, a second order phase transition from a long range order state, but rather it much more like some sort of a spin glass regime, in which you have nine non-divergent spin-spin correlation lines. So that's sort of the message I want to drive through. So I'll stop here.
Wave vector, right? In contrast to the spin glass stuff, you have the actual wave vector here. So it's just
But in the case of
contrast to what you just showed.
Well, the spin glass, you have two types of spin glass. You have completely disordered, or you have short range order, right? Because even in the lanthanum strontium copper oxide or lanthanum barium copper oxide, you know, I mean, people call this regime spin glass. In fact, you know, these widths are resolution limited within the plane. I mean, it's just terminology, right?
But some of the they do see omega over t scaling for many momenta, which, however, doesn't mean that it's not a second order phase transition. There's also no indication that this material seems to be a spin glass. I mean, I don't know, you know, maybe much better than I do.
You're referring to serum copper
gold. Yes, serum copper gold, yeah.
The data showed here were other systems,
right,
were
but
much, yeah, yeah.
Which are much more strongly disordered, right?
Right, right.
Oh, yeah,
we may know.
Yeah,
but I thought I saw this.
Yeah, but this is the stuff we did. But Megan has done this first. Yeah.
I guess yes.
Yeah. But even in
just a bit over T scaling for various momenta. But I don't think thinking completely different from the spin glass. You see what I'm trying to do.
I guess this list mixes up a number of very different things.
Yes.
I guess your copper gold is completely different from uranium, copper, palladium.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is quite different from this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're in the discussion section. There's still time for some.
I mean, this is, you know, as I said, I mean, this data is so new that, I mean, I'm not sure my interpretation is, but I can, you know, reasonably assure you that the data is good. Yeah. So I'm not sure, you know, I have the, yeah. Oh! You mean? Yeah. Initially, I thought. I mean, these AF orders are truly, truly long range. I mean, now I have to think about it. There's some more to do, because at least at the time when we did it on the regular triple axis, which our coherence length is not that fantastic, in about 200-300 angstroms, maybe not long ranged. But I'm not sure. You know, with better resolution. This will still be, you know, resolution limited or not? Because neutron has a, you know, finite coherence length, right? You can only measure, you know, what your coherence length. You know, anything beyond that, you're just going to be resolution limited. So I think a fair way of saying it is will be that probably deserves more close scrutiny to see whether the thing is really, really long range and how long it is. The whole dope within the plane is also resolution limited, the elastic stuff. But along the c-axis, it's not. At least, I mean, from as far as I know, right? I mean, I'm not sure. Beyond 12%, then you open up a spin gap.
I was kind of wondering about your scaling analysis, because for this one sample which you showed first, I think it had the temperature of 40 Kelvin and the superconductor temperature of 20 Kelvin. So over the temperature range, which you analyze as two phase transitions in addition to your maybe quantum point. So I'm kind of wondering why in the world you would expect scaling in the first place when you cross two more phase transitions.
No, in fact, what I was going to say is that this the omega T scaling only occurs roughly around, I mean, our temperature is not that precise, right? It's roughly around above this. Below that, it seemed to deviate.
Yeah,
Below TN, below TN seem to deviate.
Okay, so, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
The appeal about the spin glass quantum critical quantum, of course, that at least in some way far on the horizon, it gives maybe the opportunity to understand that peculiar linear resistivity. We have some mean field theories which go into that kind of direction. What bothered me about that picture, though, was that the linear resistivity, of course, was very, very large temperature. Yet the spin glass physics, which you were, has typically been seen, actually occurs in a rather low temperature region. Can you, what is the upper temperature cutoff for this type of physics?
Well, I mean, our upper temperature cutoff will be, you know, when the signal goes away, right? When we measure.
Right.
So in our case, you know, when you measure above, 100K, the signal gets so weak and so broad
that
you can't really subtract the background very well. So I'm not claiming, you know, this data means that above 100K omega t scaling breaks down. All I'm saying is that, you know, we just can't do very good measurement around that regime.
Can you put up the phase diagram again with the antiferromagnet and?
You mean this?
Yeah, there was another one that showed. Anyway, this
the
is fine.
One.
So
the next one?
Yeah, this one. So in the region, in the electron dope, in the antiferromagnet, you do see a spin wave in the extreme antiferromagnet.
Oh, yeah, it? Yeah. Oh, yeah, here, yeah. Oh, yes.
Say that the same peak gets, so now you, as you go toward further doping, gets broader and broader and broader.
Yes.
But doesn't move from the pi-pi point.
No, this is the data plotted on top of each other. And this is a scroll sample without annealing. This is annealing when it become 21K. And then I plot this one. And this is a 21K sample, and then this is a 23K sample. On the same instrument, same resolution, everything the same.
Now in terms of the resistivity, are these, you know, because of the way you're making them, are these much cleaner than the whole dope?
Boy, that's a tough question. I'm sure I can answer that question, yeah.
What about the value of the resistivity?
Actually, I mean, on these samples, we just started the very, very systematic measurement, you know, very recently, within a month. Because, I'm not a transport guy, so whatever I do, people won't believe me. So, my postdoc, I mean, Shi Liang, he's trained as a transport person. So he's doing, I mean, he said our resistivity is not quite as good as the thin films from Rick Green's group, but comparable to you know what Yuichi was able to do. So what we're now trying to do is to, you know, use this method to systematically drive the stuff, you know, from a long range order antiferromagnet to full blown superconductor, and then systematically study the resistivity as a function of temperature, and then systematically study the upper critical field. You know, I have a, you know, private PPMS, so he just that's what he's doing at the moment. So we don't know the answer at this point. I mean, this is so new. Right? All this data, you know, is new.
Any questions? Doesn't seem to be the case. So, thank the speaker.